5, 4, 3, 2, 1.
Model Moon!
The dark side of the Huddle Moon. Immutably amazing crypto wisdom. On today's episode, we talk to HODL investor and author of Confessions of a Crypto Millionaire, Dan Conway. We talk about his corporate hell, discovering crypto and Ethereum, full spectrum HODL warfare, how he managed to cash out while still holding a moon bag, and how he goes about writing. Dan's stories are out of this world, so we had to interview him on the dark side of the HODL moon.
Copy. This show is proudly sponsored by Salamantech's point-of-sale devices and software. Tired of all the headaches dealing with cryptocurrency? You don't know what a private key is? You don't want to deal with exchanges? Well, if you're a business and you just want to run your business without thinking about cryptocurrency headaches, look no further than Salamantech's. We provide point-of-sale software that allows you to get paid in fiat currency, that's euros, allowing your customers to pay in cryptocurrency, that's BTC, ETH, and a host of others.
Dark Side of the HODL Moon proudly uses the audio services of Eye the Sound. Beyond the amazing sound production, they've really been a sounding board, pun intended, for our show, giving us great customer support and constructive criticism and feedback. So if you want a little bit more personalized attention you're not going to get from a bigger provider, check out iTheSound.com.
HODL Moon!
All right, Josh, how are you doing today on the dark side of the HODL Moon?
I'm doing great, Cade. I'm on the other side of the world as normal in South Korea. And how are you doing in America?
I'm doing great. I'm really excited. We got a really interesting guest today. He's a husband, a father, a former crypto executive, author, writer, and if I dare say so myself, he's a true HODL warrior. So with no further ado, Dan Conway, how are you doing today?
Great. Hey, thanks for having me on, guys.
Yeah, Dan, I heard you just got back from Sundance. How was Sundance this year?
Sundance was great. It was, a few years ago, I saw someone on social media say they were at Sundance, and I frankly didn't even know that was a thing one could do. I never thought about, I love movies. I love books and movies. And so we looked into it, and this is our second year. My wife and I have gone. We have three kids, so my sister comes and stays with the kids, and it's a great opportunity just to like chill out. And we watched 14 movies in 3 days, so I'm a little movied out for the time being, probably for the next week at least.
Sundance and chill. It sounds like
exactly.
Any chance you're gonna maybe turn your book into a movie?
Well, it's funny, and we didn't talk about this before, but I have interest from a Hollywood producer, and I just got the offer today, in fact, and so I'm going to Sundance as a fan, but I'm also learning a lot about independent film and things like that, and so these things. It looks like I'm going to be the equivalent of sell the movie rights. And the way that works is it would be, they'd have a right for a year to try to build up funding, write a script, find a director, maybe attach some talent to it and see if they could, if there's interest. And then if they can do it, then, maybe a movie gets made and then if they can't do it, the rights revert back to me. So, I've had a lot of people on, say, oh, it could be a great movie. And I thought it would be too. I mean, I love movies. And when I was living all this, I thought, wow, this could be a movie. But it's, you can't get your hopes too high because it's a really long process to get a movie made, but super exciting.
Yeah. So you're kind of taking a hands-off approach. You're kind of giving it off to someone else and seeing if they can go for it.
Yeah. The way it works is like I have the intellectual property, the book, and I know nothing about making a movie, no matter how many movies I've seen. So this guy's a producer. I'll let you guys know if it comes through, but you haven't asked it. I wouldn't mention who it is yet. He's not like a huge famous person, but he's a totally legit producer that's had movies before. And he's had one that premiered at Sundance as part of the company he's at. And the way you do it is I wrote the book. It would be hands off with the movie. I don't know how to write a screenplay, which is be the next step. And so, I'd probably be like a, someone if and when this goes through, I'd be someone to offer like creative ideas and, but at some point the movie becomes its own thing.
Yeah, definitely. That's really interesting. If it comes out, I'll definitely check it out. And if you need any HODL model extras, I'm there for you.
I know. I'd be trying to get myself in as an extra first. I definitely wouldn't play me. They'd have someone much, much more handsome in the title role.
But it reminds me of that book, Yes Man, that was a really great book. And then it was converted into a movie with Jim Carrey. So that was pretty cool.
That's right. Yeah, yeah. And there's one now, Justice. It's the one with Michael Jordan plays the lead role, Justice, Mercy Justice. Or I can't remember the name of it. Anyway, it was a memoir, and then it got turned into a book. That, I mean, that guy's got like a truly amazing story.
Are you a basketball fan?
Yes. I mean, yeah, I'm a casual fan, but yes.
Oh, man, did you hear the news? Well, obviously, everyone heard the news. Kobe's passing. That was terrible. What a tragedy. Yeah.
When we were at Sundance and we saw this movie by this African-American director who turned out to be a big basketball fan. And he actually did like a big, he didn't talk about his movie. He just talked about Kobe. Everyone was really shocked. Yeah. Terrible, man. Awful.
Wow. Yeah. Rest in peace, man. I mean, he was one of the greats. I remember even in England, we knew Kobe when I was a kid. So I even had his Kobe basketball shoes when he was number 8 before he had the 24. So that was really shocking to me when I woke up the other day and found out that news. So
seems like he had a lot more to do too, you know?
Yeah, we're just getting started, really. All right, then.
All right, well, let's get into a little bit of your backstory, Dan. So your book is really interesting, but it's covered a little bit in the book. You've done some other interviews. I really haven't heard you talk much about it. So I kind of want to learn a little bit more about Dan Conway, pre-Acme, pre-corporate world, pre-crypto world. So you can take it wherever you want. Like, where'd you grow up? Like, what was your upbringing like? And all that kind of stuff.
Yeah, yeah. Okay, well, yeah. So I grew up in San Mateo, California, which is maybe like the northern edge of Silicon Valley. And I was, you know, I'm 49, almost 49. So so actually I'm 48 and a half. My birthday's in June. So let me give myself a little extra youth there. But, so I was born in 1971, and growing up, it wasn't really all about Silicon Valley here. You know, it's just, there were companies, of course, HP and all that, but it wasn't like kind of the everywhere you go now around here, most people work in tech, or like a lot of people work in tech. So it was a typical American suburb. I was always ambitious as a kid. You know, felt like I wanted to do something big. I mean, you know, everyone kind of feels that in some ways. So I don't know how unique that is. But I went to high school. You know, the book covers kind of my emotional travails. I had a bad middle school. And these things have, you know, the reason why I talk about these things is because I think they explain how I got to a place when crypto comes in. But I suffered from depression when I was younger, and it hit me in middle school like it often does. And I had a really miserable middle school. Depression for people that have it, it kind of hits you like a dark cloud. It's like a curtain, and it's like a dark cloud, the fog that comes in. And so I had a couple of years there where everything kind of fell apart, and then it just kind of mysteriously lifted in high school. And I had a great high school. I was ambitious. I was like, you know, ran for student government. I was class president and all this stuff, prom king, a lot of glory. And then just like when I went to college, it hit, like depression hit again. So I would say, and then the book kind of details how, you know, it kind of damaged me in a way. You know, we all get damaged in some way, but the depression, and which turned into like drinking too much and eventually doing pills and really some reckless behavior. It started in youth with some of the depression that happens to run in my family too. I was like of average intelligence. I was a hard worker. I ended up going to UC Davis for college, which is a good college now. It's like impossible to get into. It wasn't that hard to get into when I went there. And when the depression hit, the only good upside was that I really just like, I threw myself into studies and like I hadn't before. And I just became a real student. And I ended up transferring to Georgetown and doing well there, graduating with honors, and then going into high-tech PR in the beginning part of my career. And that really was my career, public relations, helping make announcements for product launches, for executive signings, for, you know, acquisitions and things like that. And living in the Bay Area, and I other than college, and then 1 year in Montana, where I did this thing called the Jesuit Volunteer Corps, which is like a 1 year Peace Corps kind of thing. Not really a religious. You're not like, you know, trying to make people become Catholic. I helped worked in a thrift store. It was great. In the grunge era, so I had like all the best flannels because we could pick them all up then. But I I fell into high tech PR, and eventually, you know, like the whole economy around here is high tech, as I mentioned. So that's the brunt of my career. Is that enough background color?
Yeah. You were in the grunge scene. Were you a big Nirvana fan? And what were your?
Yes, I was never. See, this is the interesting thing. I never really got deep into a subculture. Yes, I was a Nirvana fan, but I wasn't early to it. You know, I wasn't early to Nirvana. I would like listen to them on the radio and have their albums and stuff. But, I was pretty much a mainstream guy, maybe with an edgy sense of humor.
Okay, and so you weren't like a skater or a surfer or a jock or.
I was in middle school when the depression hit. I became a skateboarder and I was like super into skateboarding. I even had a skateboard magazine called Road Rash when I was like 12. Because I always liked to write, and that was super fun. That kind of skateboarding kind of saved me, you know, in some ways at that time, because that actually was a subculture. I mean, I was so young though; I was like, you know, 11, 12, 13, but I really considered myself a skater during that period. And then in high school, I grew out of it, and it was, you know, more like, you know, one of the mainstream kids kind of thing.
No, I think that's a good wrap up of your little pre-corporate bio. So you're doing PR, and I want to know, when you first heard about crypto, where were you? What were you doing? How did you hear about it?
Well, there's two distinct memories of crypto. One is not distinct. And it was, you know, one of those memories where we still read newspapers, even in like 2000, I don't know, 11, 12, something like that. And when Bitcoin went bonkers and hit 1400, and then of course with Mt. Gox and all that stuff, I definitely read about it then. And I don't remember where I was, don't remember anything about it, but I knew what Bitcoin was. And my general impression was that it was, you know, something I wasn't going to do. I was more just something I was, you know, it was like a video game niche, like some weird video game thing that people ended up losing a lot of money. I didn't have any strong feelings like, you know, oh, this is bullshit. The US dollar is like the only thing around or whatever. It just seemed like it was just too weird for me to ever consider investing in. And it was just, it seemed like something that it was like from outer space, you know? So it was just more like I read it for, it was a lot, but there was a lot of drama, which there still is. So, you know, being someone who consumes a lot of news, I just remember reading about Mt. Gox and the whole crazy run up and crash and all that, but never in any context of how it would involve me.
Yeah. So that was your first vague recollection of hearing it in passing. And then what, I guess that was when Mt. Gox happened. That was pretty early, the $1,300 run up. And then at one point you read about it or heard about it again, and it really clicked for you.
Yeah, it did. I remember this. I was at a company that I call Acme, and I was, you know, at the headquarters, and I was in the midst of a really miserable corporate experience. And the bottom line there was, you reach a certain point in your career, my career at least, and to rise any further, you needed to have this thing called executive presence. And, you know, I still don't know exactly what it is, but it focuses a lot on leadership and leadership qualities and, you know, soft skills and vision and, you know, managing people, you know, really easily and things like that. And I was working my ass off and struggling to try to do it, but I could never really do it. I wasn't really cut out for it. And so it was like kind of kept like running my head into a brick wall over and over. And not only was I not able to rise up any further, which I really wanted to do because I was ambitious. Living here in the Bay Area, it's really expensive. And, you know, it's, even though I made a good salary, I was making 150 grand a year. That's a lot of money for a lot of people, most people in the country. But, you know, it was tough. You know, we were right on the edge even at that, because we have a big mortgage and all that. So it was during one of the more miserable times that I remember sitting at my desk and some article, I would look for new jobs on, like, you know, the tech sites. And there was some article about Bitcoin and how it was like at $300. And it was from an article from someone, and I can't find the article, nor I don't even remember the exact date, but it was in 2015. It was like early 2015, maybe mid, I think it was early 2015. And I read about Bitcoin, and I had a totally different experience reading about it. And I think it was part of the fact that I was so miserable, you know, and I had thought.
So would you say that being miserable, looking into crypto is kind of a form of escapism because of lack of job satisfaction and looking for something else.
Yeah, it really was. It really was. And also, earlier in my career, I'd been miserable is too strong of a word, but I had been unsatisfied, let's say that, earlier in my career. And I had started to learn about this FIRE movement, financially independent, retire early, which is now kind of a big thing. And I had read this book, Your Money or Your Life, and I was interested in finance and investments and things like that, and was always watching my 401k, a believer in compound interest and the miracle of that over time, which I still believe in. So this time when I was reading about crypto right from the start, and I think it was because I had been searching and trying to think, my wife and I were like, hey, should we move to Portland? It might be cheaper to live there, that kind of stuff. I was definitely like in a more like open mindset. I'd come to the terms that, like, you know, I don't think I'm going to become like an executive. I really wanted the money to have a more comfortable life. I was tired of living on the edge all the time, even though most people in the country would trade my position for theirs. I don't say that lightly, but that's just the way it was. And so when I read about this time, it was absolutely, you know, the article was like how it had gone so low, and it was by someone who thought this is a dip, it's going to go back up at some point, this kind of stuff. And so, like, right away, I was like, holy shit, I got to buy some Bitcoin, man. Even though I didn't have the money and I didn't do it right away. In fact, I didn't buy Bitcoin. I bought, you know, ETH, But I really went down the rabbit hole starting that exact day.
Yeah, definitely. So while you were still in the corporate world, I think you really got into crypto. You were researching it a lot, you know, going to meetups. And also, you kind of relapsed a little bit. You were drinking and doing pills. Can you talk a little bit about that?
Well, so I had already like been in quote recovery at that point, thankfully. In 2012. Let me just think about this. Yeah. 2012 is when my first couple of years at Acme, I was drinking too much. The drinking was always just like super heavy drinking, the drunkest person at the party. That alone didn't get me in too much trouble. But then I had a bad back. I got a prescription for Vicodin. I couldn't sleep. I got some Ambien. And eventually I found myself like buying opioids on Pill Hill in San Francisco in the Tenderloin. And I became a complete drug addict. I was high functioning. I didn't let everything fall apart, mainly. But by the time after I got sober, there was this period where I thought, oh my God, I felt so much better. You know what I mean? I thought, hey, I'm sober now. I can do this company. I can make this work. And I did for a while. And then I started to hit the same exact, make stupid mistakes, blunders, say stupid shit in meetings. Like, you know, those are just the day to day examples, but I just, you know, people above were looking at me and being like, oh, this guy, he's kind of like a joker, man. He doesn't really fit in here in this hardcore business culture. And that's when I was open to crypto, but I was sober, yeah. Thankfully.
Okay, good. So that was a little bit earlier then. So I want you to kind of expand a little bit. You've talked about executive presence, which is really just a fancy way of saying like people skills and, you know, leadership and, you know, having some sort of like social awareness or situational awareness. But can you talk a little bit about this corporate structure you mentioned in the book, like trying to go from one floor to another?
Yeah.
The different levels. Can you talk about the wild computer system, your workplace humor and why it didn't work? You know, I kind of feel like maybe me and you have a somewhat similar sense of humor, and I don't think I would fit in the corporate world either, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I was like a grown ass man at this point. It wasn't like I was like a 20 something, but when I got to Acme, it was a very old company and very centralized. One of the companies, and I talk about it as a composite in the book. And it was based on levels of management. That's the whole company is based on levels of management. And it basically was, you know, there's the first levels were like the receptionists and the tech workers. Second levels were like, you know, minor managers. Third levels were like, okay, you're a director. You have like five or six people. You're doing a function. And then where I was, I was one level above that. And then I was a fourth level. And at fourth level, you're supposed to be able to like whiteboard the shit out of a problem, you know, while everyone like looks on in admiration. And you were supposed to like, you know, see in the distance, like, you know, have vision into the future. And you just like, you know, like this company, you're supposed to have, you know, I've always had a nice firm handshake, but you're supposed to have everything else that goes with that, you know, like, you know, the right jokes to say, you're comfortable, you know, managing people with a bit of, you know, that sort of like executive temperament, supposed to like believe that, oh, okay, you're really like mentoring these people and stuff. And I, you know, it's just like, I felt like I was a good manager. I was loyal to my people in a certain way, but I had a hard time advocating for them up the chain. I was always better at working with them than like, you know, positioning our department, because I would, you know, I would sometimes get nervous and say a joke that, you know, that maybe crossed the line a little bit. People thought was funny, but you know, the people I talk about in Red State in the book, you know, the corporate headquarters were not in California, and it just didn't quite fit. And I think a lot of that comes, so it was like a lot of it came from me, because I just thought a lot of what was going on was bullshit. And I felt like at this company, this company was like concentrated, all the ways that I didn't really enjoy corporations in the past, it was all concentrated. And we spent so much of our time politicking. I mean, all the conversations were about, where do you stand? Who's going to go up? Who's going to go down? It was like, it was like a TV miniseries, like all the politics and drama. And I was in a tough position organizationally too, because my division, and this is like just so typical, you know, I reported to another division sort of from my team in California, and there was a rivalry going on between the two divisions. So I was kind of caught in the middle. And as I say, someone with really good corporate skills could have probably handled that, but I couldn't. I never could quite figure out the positioning. It was a difficult challenge, but I definitely wasn't up to it. And I just, it was the focus and the value people placed on people depended on their levels. And, you know, it just didn't feel human. And it was all run by what I call the machines in the book, which is the compliance systems. And, you know, yes, we all have compliance systems, but I'd had them before, and I'm not like, you know, oh my God, I'm going to rage because I have to fill out a report. But this was just insane. These computer systems, you know, it was like you spent 20% of your day, which is a lot, just trying to fill out reports and answer systems. You get these bot emails would be like, you have access to this system. Please tell us why you have access. What have you been using it for? And then it would send you to a screen that was like created in 1983. And it was like, you couldn't fill in part of the thing. Like, this form's incomplete. It was like, what the fuck? Like, I don't even know I have access to this system. And it's like an internal joke at the company, but it really felt like they were malevolent, you know, like they were out to get you. And so these things all fit together in my frame of mind when I discovered, you know, crypto.
Yeah, man, that makes a lot of sense. I mean, I always think that company fit is extremely important. I personally don't like the excessive hierarchies in companies either. In Korea, in every company, you've got a Sawon, a Deri, a Gwajang, a Chajang, a Bujang, an Icha, all the way up to a Depyeon. These are all the different hierarchy levels. And this will be even in a company of 40 people or something like that. I mean, they love putting hierarchy in. And then you get into a huge company like Samsung or something like that, and then it's even worse. So I also the kicking the box. Like, they love kicking boxes, having a system, but no thinking is required, just lots of box ticking. So
yes,
definitely can relate.
Yeah, the never-ending Korean hierarchy in the corporate structure, it's wild. Probably even worse than Acme, but
I've heard that about Korea. Yeah, and I've also heard there's a lot of partying after work.
Well, yeah, but it's kind of forced partying. So maybe the first week or two, it's entertaining. But then, like, third week on, it's an obligation that you have to do. You're like, all right, have to go drink with the boss. So
yeah,
I guess I'll be coming home at 1 a.m. again. And then you'll still have to be back in the chair the next day early in the morning. So we can get into that another time, but I definitely can relate. Yeah.
Sure. Dan, imagine your boss inviting you out for dinner and drinks with all of your coworkers. workers and you have to go and get drunk every week, how would that sound to you?
Oh my God. I mean, even when I was drinking, I probably would want to, that would be too much. I can't even imagine, because I'm a bit of an introvert, which just means you get your strength from being alone. So that would be like hell.
Yeah. All right. Well, let's change topics here now. So you're still in the corporate world. You're kind of in this corporate holding pattern, and you read about Ethereum and talk about how you really got excited about it. Why were you more excited about Ethereum than Bitcoin?
Yeah. The thing about it was that, and this is the reason why it led to making such a big bet. Looking back on it and analyzing it as best you can, your own mind, you know, as I did in the book, is okay. The first number one thing, the reason why I was reading in the first place was, you know, I wanted to make a bunch of money. I thought this is a potential, you know, parachute. This is a potential, you know, way to get out of the corporate grind. Again, I've been studying all the, you know, FIRE and things like that. So I was like, wow, if this stuff goes up again, you know, and I had been, you know, reading all the sites, you know, tons of people thought Bitcoin was going to go back to 50 grand, you know, or not back to, go to like 50 grand, you know, $1 million someday. I mean, all that stuff was like, you know, I call it retirement porn. And I was like completely addicted. But then, you know, because considering my recovery mindset, trying to be sane about things, trying not to just do escape, I'm not sure if I would have invested. I might have, but the karma wouldn't have been there for it. But it was more than that. It was all the stuff I was experiencing, this centralized corporation, all the waste, all the bullshit, all the difficulties, all the like, wow, I can't believe like human beings have to like live and or work in this environment. You know, again, we're not refugees. Most people would take it, but it was pretty miserable. And so it was when I discovered Ethereum, and there was the Ethereum, you know, less focus on decentralizing money, more focus, especially then, about decentralizing organizations, decentralizing structures, the world computer that could, you know, maybe not now, maybe not tomorrow, maybe not next year, maybe in a couple decades could provide a platform for an alternative to the corporation. So it was like, holy crap. I mean, then I really went deep. And, you know, because I can be obsessive, you know, the same crap that led me to get a drug dealer and all that, because I felt like I had to have those drugs. I read, I went to meetups all over the place. And I was spending, you know, hours each day studying this stuff. Now, I'm not technical. I'm not like a programmer at all. But, you know, when I put my mind to it, I can get my arms around things. And so that's kind of the path and the more I read about it and thought about it, the more I listened to like podcasts, a lot of which were really obscure at the time. I'd hear people from, you know, all these big consulting firms and venture capitalists, they have their finger on the pulse of all this new stuff, right? That's how they keep their lead. And so I would hear like consultants from Ernst & Young talking about Ethereum on these podcasts. And it's like, wow, this is like legit, you know, this could really potentially, you know, work. A lot of smart people think it could work. And that's generally the way I judged it, was like, I thought it made sense, but then I'd hear smart people and I would try to judge whether I thought they were, you know, if they thought it made sense, that would be like another vote for me thinking, okay, this is real.
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. I think a lot of people, got in it really to make money, but they discover so many more things too. So, you know, making a lot of money and changing the world, you really can't go wrong there.
Yeah, that's exactly right. It was this like potent cocktail, kind of like green tech was supposed to be, where you could get rich and save the world. Green tech hasn't worked out financially, but it was something like that. You know, it was like, wow, you know, really amazing. And in fact, it was such a Wild West thing where even before I invested, I knew like I could do this. And I, you know, it was open. It still is. It's open to anyone to go ahead and do this. There weren't stops from it. It was kind of like all the big, gatekeepers couldn't stop you from investing like they could, like trying to buy an IPO after it goes public, or, you know, some stuff like that, where, you know, like all the big money's already been made by the people that were in early.
Yeah. So obviously you're really reading about Ethereum. You're really into it. So when did you make the plunge to invest in it? Did you start small? Did you go big? And tell us a little bit more about that.
Well, so basically I'd been reading it. So the way it works with me and my wife pays the bills, and I handle our investments, you know? And so, and she has really zero interest in like the investments. She's not curious about those. She's not interested in money. I mean, she likes to live a good life and all that. But she's just, you know, she's just never really been into talking about money. A lot of families are like that. You know, they don't, it's not considered polite or particularly interesting to talk about that. Whereas I was, you know, always interested in saying like, hey, if we keep this up in 10 years, we'll have, you know, 400 grand and for whatever the numbers were at the time, if you take like a booming stock market and our 401ks and add a decade or so. So anyway, because I did that, I had sort of convinced myself, although I hadn't even put a lot of thought into it, that I had the ability to make this investment without telling her. And so I went, I had a team meeting and I'd been thinking about it. I was working in downtown San Francisco and I left a meeting and I had already done some research. I had some wire instructions and I went down to Wells Fargo. And we had the first like windfall of our lives. My mom had sold her house and given us like, 30 or 40 grand. I had some Acme shares that had vested, and my wife's startup got acquired and she made about 30 grand and she lost her job, but she got clients right away. So we had that. So we had $100,000 cushion for the first time in our lives. And I went there and I just said, I'm doing this, man. And I was not at all nervous. I got sat down, told the guy, you know, hey, have you heard of Gemini? That's where I was going to invest. And the guy's like, no, I haven't. And I'm like, well, listen, buddy, Gemini's the future. And these marble columns here are not going to be here in a couple decades or years or whatever. And, you know, as usual, you guys probably get this too. People think you're kind of crazy when you're talking about crypto in that way. And I couldn't care less though. So, you know, he was cool and he started the wire. And then I hear my phone buzz and I look down and it's a text from my wife and it said, what WTF is this? And it had a screenshot, an alert from Wells Fargo. I'd forgotten that she was the one who was getting the alerts from our bank. And so I had to tell the guy like, oh, hey, I need to, can you pause the wire? He's like, oh, yes, sir. Yes, sir. And I had to, you know, go out on the sidewalk and call her and, you know, just be like, oh, yeah, I was meaning to tell you about this. Yeah. And that was, she was, yeah. You know, especially my background, she was not impressed.
Yeah, your secret investment wasn't so secret when she has a notification. Josh, would your wife let you put all your, go all in on some Korean altcoin?
Certainly not now anyway, but maybe back in the day. I bet she wishes that we had, you know. There have been so many times where I've been like, we need to put more in, we need to put more in. And she's like, I'll just put a little bit then. And a couple of months later, I was like, I told you. She's like, oh, doesn't matter. So yeah, I think if I went YOLO, it wouldn't be right now, because I think that it's much harder to predict right now. And there's so much more information. But back then, back in 2016, when I was first buying Bitcoin, well, first buying it like to invest in it rather than just to use it. Yeah, I really wish I would have gone bigger, to be honest. But you live and you learn.
Yeah, well, maybe you can show your wife this show when it goes live and convince her to go a little bit more into the crypto space. But let's get back to Dan here.
The thing I've got to ask you, Dan, is like, did you have three kids at that time, or was it two kids or one on the
other? I had three.
That makes it different, right? Because I've got two kids now, yeah. So I'm like, that would also change my risk. But it seemed like you were like, YOLO, go for it.
It was. I mean, I had worked myself up into a fever and I was hitting on all cylinders. The addict in me was just like, do it. But then also, you know, the thinking part of me, like the whatever intellect I have was like, this is the future. And, you know, you're in early potentially here. And I would not recommend people do what I did. In fact, the book is just trying to understand how it happened. And because I haven't been that kind of a gambler in anything else. And I'm not today after, you know, I sold a significant portion, but it was, you know, just a unique cocktail that I'm fortunate, obviously, because it, you know, it worked out. But I wouldn't recommend it to others. Although, I also wouldn't necessarily recommend people go too conservative either. I'm not saying to do what I did, but I'm also not saying that if you have a strong conviction that you wouldn't take some form of risk, because, you know, I still believe it's the future and I still believe we're just in a big valley and I still think it's going to go back up.
Yeah, definitely. So you're on the sidewalk with your wife and somehow you talk her into letting you go all in, huh?
Yeah, it was, and this is the part people have most questions about. And I had to, like, when I was writing the book, go back and we had a lot of discussions because even she doesn't quite understand it. But we, it took about a week, and she ultimately, you know, I worked on her carefully, and she was not convinced that it was like a great move. She also wasn't convinced that it was, you know, that it was like a crazy move. She knew that there was some possibility, but I got a text. I was at the gym, you know, part of my recovery, trying to get, you know, trying to stay in good shape, keep my mental self in order. And I got a text in the middle of the gym that said, you know, here's the deal. You can invest it all if we have family trips to Costa Rica, Cinque Terre, Italy, Mexico, and what was the other one? Disneyland. Oh, Disney Cruise. And we have to do these within the next 18 months. If you do that, you can do what you like with the money. And, you know, crazy. I mean, this is like, we wouldn't take, we would not be taking any of these trips before. But I would have done anything. I mean, I was like, yes, you have a deal. Like, boom. Oh.
That's a pretty easy deal. You can spend money if I can spend money.
Exactly. Financial ruin could result. But yes, it was a good deal. And see, it kind of like her values were the family vacations, family trips. And she's not an idiot. She doesn't want to just like constantly go on trips. And so that's why what she said later was that I was like so inspired. This is kind of touchy-feely, but I was like so inspired. And I was so happy to be in this and felt so great about it that she didn't want to break the spell. And
yeah,
you know,
definitely.
Yeah. So that's how we, that, and after that, she said, basically she wanted to tune out what was going on with the investment, and not even that she was particularly stressed about it. She just has an ability to block it out and to, you know, to really, not think about it. You know, unlike me, I was, you know, obviously constantly thinking about it, but, so it wasn't like a big source of a major source of tension in our relationship. It would come up sometimes, but even when bad things happen, I wouldn't tell her about it, you know, and some bad things happen. So, you know, I just kind of kept that to myself.
Yeah. Well, I think that's a good deal for both sides, because obviously the investment worked out and you probably still remember some of those trips. I think traveling and doing those things is huge for people.
Yeah, it was. And, you know, different things happened on different trips relating to crypto. And it was, and in general, that's what we do with our money is we don't buy like fancy stuff, but we go on a lot of trips. And it's not because we're such great people. We're not, I mean, people just have different things they want to do, you know? I mean, but luckily, thank God, she's not like a big person, like a big clothes horse, and I'm not either. You know, we don't have new watches and stuff like that.
Yeah, definitely. Some people invest in things. Some people invest in experiences. I like a little mix.
Yeah, exactly.
Half and half.
Exactly. And if you do too much of both, then you can get in trouble, because we do spend a lot on travel, and we did then. But luckily, it's compensated by the fact that, you know, I still drive my same minivan, and, you know, I've just never been a car person. I hate shopping for cars, thinking about all the features and stuff. So anyway.
Oh, man. So
are you still in the same house then?
Yeah, same house.
There you go. So you like Warren Buffett, you know?
Oh, no.
Same house from the whole time.
Dan, so you hodled, but you didn't buy a Lambo or a red Ferrari?
Oh, my God. Can you imagine? Can you imagine how obnoxious that would be if I showed up in a Lambo?
But what if you just showed up to Acme in that Lambo and just said hi at lunch and drove off?
I thought about various scenarios, mainly for book marketing. Like, what could I do to make a viral video? And I just realized, all right, this is not really what. But
it's not who you were, really. Right?
It wasn't.
You just
really
wanted to escape the corporate grind, and it sounded like you just want to live a more straightforward life with less bullshit and less petty politics. And you're just glad to get out of there as soon as you could.
That's right. I did. And I wanted to. I'm lucky too that I like to write. You know, because, you know, if you don't know what you want to do, if you have the time, it's a tough one, because you do lose your identity when you leave your job. You know, I was consulting after I left Acme before the investment went up. And, you know, so that was fine. But, you know, when you leave a job entirely, and I know, cause I have a couple friends who have actually made it big in Silicon Valley. Most people don't. It's like, you know, they get close, you know, their options get diluted. It's, you know, there's like really the blanket gets pulled out from under them a lot of times, right when they think they're going to make it. But some of those guys, one guy goes back to work and he's like head of product marketing at a big company because he missed the camaraderie and things like that. But I'm lucky. I like to write.
Yeah. Yeah. I've never really worked much in the corporate world in the sense that I would at some place like Acme, but I never would want to either. I want to talk a little bit before about leaving Acme. Can you kind of talk about you made the investment and if what kind of investment mistakes you made? Did you invest more money? How was it riding the wave? You know, I would, you know, reading the book, I would probably call you like a full spectrum HODL warrior. But can you kind of tell us like what happened and how you manage it? Because you said your wife didn't really care. You're going on trips. But obviously, you know, when I was investing, a lot of other people were investing. You know, you're doing it 5, 6, 7 hours a day after work. You're not sleeping. You're constantly checking the price. Was that you?
Yeah, that was totally me. I was completely, completely obsessed, completely focused on it. And so we made the investment in June of 2015. Yes, June of 2015. So a week after I made the investment, it was my birthday and we were walking to breakfast. And, you know, I was like hooked up on crypto Twitter and Reddits and everything. And my phone just started like blowing up with, you know, with different, you know, different, my phone was blowing up because the Dow got hacked. And so ETH had gone up to 21. I'd bought it like 14 or 15 and it had gone up to 21. So I was, you know, up, I can't remember, 30 grand or something, which is amazing. You know, I was up 30 grand, unbelievable. And it crashed. It was like Ethereum's dead. I knew that was a sensationalist headline. But, you know, the Dow was this thing that attracted all the attention in crypto, and Wall Street Journal, New York Times, all, you know, Wired, everyone had covered it. It was like a venture capital fund decentralized without a venture capitalist. And when it got hacked, it was obviously wasn't a hack of Ethereum. It wasn't a flaw in Ethereum, but it was a flaw in a Dow contract. My take was it was rushed out. At the time though, it was crazy because the pressure that the community was putting on the folks that were running the DAO, that ran the DAO, which is just a contract on the Ethereum blockchain, was immense because it was, I mean, there was just already, this is before the big boom, but there was this euphoria, you know, because Ethereum had gone, Ether had gone up from like 20 cents to, you know, $20. So, you know, it was at $20, just like the story of crypto, whatever it's at now, you think, oh my God, I wish I got in early. But back then it was like these early hodlers were like already filthy rich and everyone else wanted a piece of the action. The DAO was getting all the action. So it was like, let's just do this. And the big, I remember even feeling some frustration, even though I never invested in the DAO, I didn't understand it entirely. I just already had such a big play in Ether that I had no desire to. And I heard a couple podcasts. That's the advantage of listening to these things. You just listen to the podcasts as much as you can. You can hear people talk about it. And they didn't seem like, you know, I don't want to have 20/20 hindsight, but I didn't invest because I just thought, oh, someone asked them, like, what if one of these projects that you invest in, it was like they were going to like rent, you know, on a blockchain, rent bikes and apartments and things like that, was one part of one aspect of what it might do. Fund projects that do this. Slockit was the name of the company. Stephen Twal. And he's like, well, won't lawyers get involved in the real world? And he's like, well, I don't know. We'll see. And it was kind of like, okay, I, you know, as a grown ass man, I knew like, okay, that's not going to work. Like, this is a little sketchy sounding. So I think they, in retrospect now, it's very clear they rushed it out and they were also immature in managing it. Someone had pointed out a flaw in the hack, a flaw in the contract a week before it was actually hacked. The name's escaping me. It was the Cornell professor. I can't remember his name. But anyway, and so what I thought was this is a setback. I never thought it was like anything truly significant. I mean, I was so ingrained and was following Ethereum so closely. It was, I knew this wasn't a flaw in the design. I knew there was tons of other smart contracts coming out. I knew that there was tons of mature voices, including Vitalik, who were looking at it. And then, of course, the whole, you know, that were had a reasonable, mature perspective on the whole thing, which is what I wanted to hear most. And then there was the whole debate about whether or not to break the contract and to get the money back. And I was always in the camp that you should, because I didn't come into Ethereum as a libertarian, or, you know, I came in as someone more practical, you know, from like the mainstream world. And I didn't think that that would set some precedent that the Ethereum contracts can be rolled back if Vitalik says they should. I figured it was so early in the development that it really wasn't a big deal. And soon that the Ethereum blockchain would be so big that there's no way that that anyone that that some other projects would be able to get a rollback if something went wrong. And that's proven to be true, while controversial, when there was the problem with the parity bug in the wallet, and there was, I think, $100 million locked up. And these guys obviously had very good Ethereum connections, and they couldn't get it unraveled. So, but it was really unfortunate. So I had bought in June, and then by December, you know, my initial, I think I bought at 14 and it was down to like $6. So, and that was in 6 months. So it was a disaster. You know, I mean, it was like we were down just a shitload of money. And then, do you want me to talk about the one trade I made?
Was this was a good trade, wasn't it?
Well, this is one. No, this was a bad one. So basically I was such a true believer. I was not really shaken or worried about it, and I didn't even mention it to Eileen. So, basically I was thinking, okay, well, you know, I had enough information about crypto trading to be dangerous. And, oh, I'm sorry, I screwed up. This was after June. So June I bought, it sank down to about $9, and we had bought it to 14 or 12. I bought it 12 at that point. So I was down $9. We had already been up way, you know, up 30 grand. Now we were down, and I thought, okay, this is the deal. This is going to like go way down. So, you know, I could see the handwriting on the wall. I thought, so I'm going to sell all my coins, you know, hold and then buy back at a lower price. So, you know, just the typical thing you want to do, right? It's like, okay, that you hear of other crypto trading's doing. So I did that, and I sold all my coins, and I was going to hold onto the money, right? So it was like at, you know, nine, I guess, or something like that. So like literally a couple hours later, I'm driving my kids to the swimming pool. We're going to go swimming. And while I'm driving, Ether starts to just pop back up. And, you know, this whole time, this whole investment was predicated on when this thing explodes, it's going to be insane and we're going to make a shitload of money. And so, and again, I was not really shaken by the DAO hack. I was so into it that I didn't think it was going to be, you know, that big of a deal ultimately. And I thought, here it is. This is, can you freaking believe this? This is the rocket ship's going to take off, and I have just sold all my coins. So we get to the pool, and I'm like slathering suntan lotion on my kids, trying to get them in the pool. And at the pool, I got on my phone and I bought back all my coins. And, but of course I was desperate. So I had to like buy some of them, like 20, 30 grand market buy, which I didn't even at that time completely understand. I mean, a market buy is, you know, in thin markets, you do a market buy, you're going to buy whatever is available at the time. And, you know, again, it was popping up, so there wasn't a whole lot available, and I got screwed. It was the stupidest trade, you know, you could ever make. And I ended up losing like 30% of my coins, I think. So it wasn't as bad as it could have been, but 30% of my coins, but the coins themselves were almost at even. But then right after I bought them back, you know what happens, just like playing blackjack in Vegas, you know, the dealer's got a six. And they end up with 21 somehow. And, it popped right after I bought back, and my average cost buy-in was like 12, 14 or 15. It just started tanking. And over the next, you know, months, it just kept going lower and lower till by December of that year, it was at $6. So we were down like 70% of our money in 6 months.
Yeah. So when the DAO hack happened, it was going down. You thought you were going to buy the dip.
Yes.
But you really sold the dip. So you panic sold and then you panic bought back in.
Totally. Yeah, it was a shit show. It was a complete nightmare. It was like, it was that thing where like right when I did something, the markets moved the opposite direction. And this is like the most money I'd ever played with in my life. You know, I'd always been conservative with it. So that was awful.
Yeah. So was this bad trade what made you decide to try your new trading strategy, full spectrum HODL warfare?
Exactly. That's well said. And that's basically it. I mean, I realized that this is not something I was not a trader. I was buying and I thought it might take years.
I mean, I really did. I thought it would take, I thought what would happen is that for Ether in particular, that there'd be some mainstream dApp, it'd be some weird little thing like CryptoKitties turned out to be, that would get mainstream attention. CryptoKitties got stopped because of the limitations of the Ethereum blockchain in its current iteration, but it would go crazy and that everyone would want it. That's when the run-up would happen. I underestimated both the fear that can happen in crypto trading and also the FOMO that, you know, would soon happen.
Yeah, definitely. So you had some downtimes, but then Ethereum really went crazy. So can you tell us a little bit about the upside, the I guess the roller coaster going up and not the roller coaster going down?
Yeah. So the other thing that I did, my biggest trade was, you know, basically, you know, I was still a true believer and I was going to these crypto meetups. I had crypto clients at this point. I was doing PR for BitGo, the crypto wallet and, you know, infrastructure company. And I was getting pitched by different smaller projects and things like that. Plus, I had one corporate client that I kept that I was able to get. So I was still immersed though in the industry. And, you know, I ended up really going, you know, really, you know, jumping the shark. And our secret weapon financially was always that we had equity in the house. You know, I mean, to get your equity in your house, you usually have to sell your house, especially as a consultant, it'd be hard to get another mortgage, but it was a safety blanket of sorts. And so I ended up pulling out $300,000 from, $250,000 from my home equity line. And I bought Ether. I bought most of that under $10. And that was really the insane one that even I made me nervous. And so now I was like this massive whale. I mean, I had never heard of anyone who had, I knew that tons of people had more Ether than this, but a lot of them were like really early, or like really rich. And I'd never heard of anyone in my position. First of all, no one talks about how many coins they have. And when I wrote this book, I decided, you know, I'm just going to talk about it. I don't care because I thought that the story gets weakened without it. But so now I was in the hole though, $250,000 of my home equity. And I think I had, it's in the book, but I had like 32,000 Ether or something like that. I was like this tremendous whale. And then it was like February of 2017. No. Wait, was it 17? Yeah, it was 17. February of 2017.
Yeah, it was definitely that time. Definitely.
Yeah.
That's when people start to ask me, like aunties, yes, and uncles, how do you buy this thing? Can you remember that when you just got random people starting to ask you, like, I've heard about this Ethereum thing, this Bitcoin thing. How do you buy it? That was the time when I realized, okay, this is going to go parabolic now. When people who've never had any interest in crypto are now asking how to buy, like, let me buy, help me. I remember people messaging me saying, if I give you $1,000, can you buy it for me and hold it for me? And when it goes up, can you return the money? That type of thing. I'm sure you had the same type of thing in February, March 2017. And then that run all the way up till December was insane.
Yeah, it was crazy because in the beginning, I mean, I had so much. I mean, I was such a whale that, you know, when it started to pop in like February, you know, it would go up like $3 and, you know, that was amazing. I mean, it was like, you know, it was like $11. It went to $14 or something like that. And it was like, or maybe to 15, and I was up like $90,000. And it was, you know, it was just almost, I had this like cognitive dissonance because I had tried to convince myself that, you know, this isn't going to go up for a long time and this kind of thing. And then, it suddenly was happening. And, you know, and that was just in the beginning, it was crazy. And then, yeah, same thing. I had, you know, it really, that started to hit more like in May, June, July. That summer was just complete insanity where same as you. And I turned so many people on to crypto and, even, you know, it wasn't my intention. I wasn't like, oh, I want you to buy this or whatever, but the way, you know, and you probably felt it too. If you had crypto, then you were so confident that like, okay, it's right. This is actually going to happen. There's no reason why it shouldn't, that people just smell that confidence. And it was, I guess I kind of had that executive presence in crypto, that ability to persuade, even though I wasn't trying to get people, but I had like 11, you know, no, I had like 6 or 7 relatives. And then like my tax guy, he started off our meeting telling me, you know, hey, I think you should sell this. And then we ended the meeting. He decided he was going to buy $10,000 worth of Ether. He called me 2 days later and he's like, I decided on $20,000. And just insanity. The guy, the insurance salesman across the street. I was still going to AA meetings. So I would, people would, you know, approach me in AA meetings because I talked a little bit about it. And it was just every walk of life. You're right. Total insanity.
Yeah, that's wild. So you're huddling it and yeah, people are asking you left and right about it. Actually, for me, it was really hard to get my family to invest and a lot of them really didn't. And even now they don't want to invest. So I didn't have really have the same experience with my family, but it didn't just go up to 14. It went up a whole lot higher and you did finally end up cashing out. But was it hard to cash out? Because a lot of people thought, oh, Ethereum, there's going to be a flipping. It's going to go to 10K. It's going to, you know, battle Bitcoin to see which one's going to go to six figures first.
Yeah, exactly. That's the crazy thing is, so it was like when really the summer started, then it really became like I couldn't sleep. And I'm not a smoker. I've smoked occasionally when I drank and things like that, but I started smoking. I'd take the dog on walks and I'd, you know, just, so, I mean, there were many, many days where I'd be up $1 million in a day. And, you know, pretty quickly I was up like $3 or $4 million and we had a financial advisor and, you know, even though I told him, and he's a great guy, like, listen, my goal here is to get like FU money. Like I want financial independence, you know, before it went up, I was like, oh, that's a great goal and all this kind of stuff. Then, you know, then when it went up like 400% in a week or, you know, 1100% in a month or whatever it was like, okay, we can cash this out and you can have 3 million. I was like, no, I'm going all the way. Like I'm not getting this nest egg and then going to, you know, go and introduce myself with a business card. Like I'm going all the way. And so I did have to sell enough to get my initial investment out. You know, in a meeting with my wife and the financial advisor, which I document in the book. But then people don't remember there was a really significant dip in, it was like, I think it was like July to September of 2017. And it was still way up, but we were down. I mean, it was at one point I had like 9 million. And during that dip, which was significant, we were down to like, you know, 2.8 million or something. It was, the numbers are in the book. Can't remember exactly. It was something like that. And yes, we were still up 2.8 million, but it was like, yeah,
Bitcoin went down to like $2,800 at that time.
Yeah, it did. And the thing about crypto is when it moves, you just never know when it's going to stop moving.
Yeah, exactly. So I was like, this is the perfect time to get more. So I love that time.
Exactly. Kindred spirits.
Yeah. Always buy the dip, man. Always buy the dip.
Exactly. Yeah. And then, you know, by the fall, then it just, you know, it was, I think it was up like 400. It was up at 400 or something like that. And then it just went ballistic. And it was like whatever scene in the movie where everything just goes like bonkers, man. Like everyone's drunk at the party or, you know, full scale warfare breaks out and people are in hand to hand combat. I mean, it was just complete and utter insanity. And
parabolic charts, green candles everywhere. You know,
totally.
You know, you're trading altcoins. I thought I was a trading genius like you, Dan. I thought, yes, like, God, I'm a genius. Like Warren Buffett, get the fuck out of my way. But then, then you realize, like, anyone can make money in a berserk market. You know,
totally. Yeah, exactly. You're like, you know, it's like you were like a prophet. You know, And people, it's funny because it's just human nature, but during the dips, no one asks you about it. But when it goes up and it's already achieved the big gains, people are all want to buy, jump in, you know? And so that was when we had the real conversation about, you know, so like right around by the end of the year, you know, it was like, I was trying to define what financial independence was. And by almost any definition, we had achieved it. We were up $14 million. And you know, I was going to pay taxes, which I did and all that. So it's less than that. You got to take out 38%. Plus we had already pulled out like, I think 1 million. So it was at a point where, you know, I didn't even have to sell all of it. And I could, you know, I could sell like 60-70% and I could achieve financial independence. And that was a tough one though, because like you said, it was the flippening was the whole thing. Ethereum's going to take over Bitcoin. It's like, yeah, it's massive. Yeah, this is bigger than it should be. But like the Beatles were bigger than they should be. Like no one says like the Beatles got too big too fast. It was like Ethereum is like it, man. It's going to take over. You know, like this is like selling Google before people knew about Google. And but I ultimately, you know, I'm like you said, Josh, I had three kids and yeah, I just couldn't deny it.
Factor. And, you know, before that, you already had that lucky kind of insight into the FIRE movement, the financial independence, retire early movement, which I'm sure that you'd also had read books like The 4-Hour Work Week and things of that nature, all that stuff. So you were like, I'm set up now, and if I just take 70% out, I never have to work a day ever again, and I'll still have way more than I originally invested, and I can still ride that rest like to wherever it goes, and it could be just like your retirement money that you can enjoy. So I think you made a smart play, especially with three kids. So you were basically right time, right place, but also right frame of mind and right background to basically appreciate the situation and take the profits, which I think is important to be able to do. You got to take profits.
Yeah. Yeah. Thank you. Yeah. I was, you know, it was just a combination of things and a lot of luck too. You know, and it wasn't all luck, and I'm not just saying that for me, but for all hodlers, because, you know, this is not easy the last 2 years and holding, you know, so many people are still holding. And, you know, this is the word you earn it though, you know? And so there is some luck that we discovered this thing, you know? But it's not easy to hold it. And you have to have a certain temperament to do it. And, but I was very fortunate that I had the financial advisor too, because, there was pressure there, just simply with the numbers. And so I sold, about almost 70% of my stack. And we were able to, you know, for about 10 or 11 million, again, all the numbers in the book. And we had 30% left. And that was, I sold at an average price of about 915. And a week later, it went up to 1400. And that would have been like $4 million more, which absolutely no one's going to shed a tear for me over that zero. Yeah. But for a week, I'm sad to say, I sent my advisor a sad sack note, like, oh my God, I can't believe I did this. And he was just like, wait a second, didn't you want financial independence? Don't you still have a big stack? I'm like, yeah, you're right. But you get into this fever, you know, you guys remember the fever. It was crazy.
Definitely. Yeah. Well, you achieved all your goals. You retired early and you're still hodling. And I believe you're probably still hodling even to this day, right?
Yes. Yeah. I have a pretty good stack and I still believe in it. And it's been tempting not to buy in, but I this is the thing. This is why I was an outlier. I just can't do it. I can't buy anymore because I already have a good number and I'm just tempting fate. I feel like I'm tempting fate in everything I do, you know?
And can I ask you, like, are you just an ETH maximalist? Do you have any other cryptos or is it just all in on Ethereum?
So basically when I was getting into Ethereum, it was like war between Bitcoin and Ether. And now it still is. But that was when I was really living it. Now I'm a little bit removed, you know. But I was so disgusted with the small block, large block debate. I don't know if you guys remember that.
Yeah, we talk about it a lot in the show. Yeah, there's BTC, BCH, BSV. And it's quite a story that really hasn't resolved itself yet.
Yeah. And, you know, that was before any of those existed. So it was all an internal debate and there was just like war. And there's a lot of people like I would hear talk about Bitcoin and I just didn't really respect them. People that didn't seem to have people skills, you know, and it sounds odd, but that's important if you're going to be an influencer in such a big project. So I never invested in Bitcoin and I was not a fan of Bitcoin and I fully wanted the flippening to happen for personal reasons because, you know, I'd been on the Reddits and I hadn't personally been in wars, but I was on that side of the war when I had my whole livelihood at stake. And since then, if I didn't own Ether, I'd definitely buy Bitcoin because I do believe in Bitcoin. I think It's just proven the test of time. I think it's a store of value. I think that I don't think it's original vision maybe that Satoshi had. People can argue about Satoshi's vision. I don't think though that it's ever going to be, I don't know. I'm no expert on it at this point, but the whole transaction thing and, you know, building out other things on Bitcoin, I don't think that's likely to happen on Bitcoin anymore, but I do think that time is the big test. And I think I've been tempted at times to sell some ETH for Bitcoin, but I'm just still too much of a believer in Ethereum. And my working in software, the one often stated fact still is the most convincing for me is just all the development happening on it. And it's not like it was before where it was Ethereum was the only smart contract platform in town, but I still think it's the one most likely to win. But so I still just own, ETH. I'm tempted sometimes to diversify a little bit, but I've never been enough to actually do it.
Yeah. I think Ethereum and a few other projects, Ethereum was one of the two projects I thought had did the most last year. So they're really doing stuff with their roadmap. And you're right. These days they do have a lot of competitors, you know, whether it's Cardano or EOS and a bunch of others, but they still seem to be building strong. So hopefully they can scale up and make things happen.
And I agree. And I do think there will be other, I'm not really a maximalist because I think that other blockchains will have value and keep value, including Bitcoin. But I just, you know, before I would make a diversification move, I have to do so much research and soul searching. I just still feel comfortable holding that. But I'm rooting for all the projects, you know. That's not true. Not all the projects.
Dan, we're on the dark side of the HODL moon here. So can you tell me which projects you're not rooting for, please?
And here's the deal. I'm not like, you know, I'm not like people should listen to this as just a dude's opinion. Like I'm not like, you don't have special insights, but you know, the whole promise of EOS, first of all, I just thought it was obnoxious. They raised so much money. I think that was a money grab. And then secondly, I just think, you know, I've gotten into crypto because of decentralization and EOS, even then before other things have borne out, was more centralized. And that was part of their value proposition. They'd be faster and they're more centralized. I've always been on take it slow and see if you can do it decentralized or else it's just going to be like everything else we have in the world. So I'm not a big fan of EOS. Ripple, at times I've been like really anti-Ripple because, you know, I don't think they're totally honest, but I kind of respect some of the people that like Ripple, and I've heard them on podcasts, including Pomps, and I'm not as so anti XRP. I wouldn't waste a lot of mental energy on it. I'd never ever invest in it. I don't think it'll ever do what it says it's going to do, but I do think there's smart, credible, and non-fraudulent people involved in the project. There's just a million altcoins though that are just. Shy scams.
Yeah, I mean, there's a million coins. Even it's hard to even keep track of the top 50. But yeah, I'm not a big Ripple fan myself. So I kind of want to rewind a little bit. So you cashed out. So can you tell me a little bit about quitting your job, how you did that? And like, you also kind of, after you quit and you cashed out, you kind of worked a little bit in the crypto industry. Can you talk a little bit about your lack of desire to work and how that came about?
So when I quit Acme, the investment hadn't paid off yet. So I was working for BitGo. I was doing their PR. And, you know, in the midst of that crazy summer of 2017, I became so violently distracted. I was, you know, up or down hundreds of thousands of dollars. It felt like every hour. And some days it was, you know, I mean, like any price movement that was significant, I would have made so I could not pull myself away from the charts. And I had these data sheets leading up to Consensus 2017 I was supposed to write. And it's just crazy because I was up like $3 million. And I was like, you know, I really don't. And I thought it was just the beginning, which it turned out to be, at least for that time frame. And I just deep down, as I look at it, I just knew I didn't have to work anymore. And this was a really difficult project. I had like various audiences. I needed to writing crypto stuff is so hard. Even if you're technical, it's just so you're describing whole new concepts. And the thing I loved before, I was just so distracted that I couldn't do it. So I actually quit BitGo like fairly before Consensus. And I felt really bad about it because they needed me. And I've since apologized. At the time I apologized to Mike Belshe, the CEO, but I could not focus on it. And Eileen was pissed. Yeah. So, yeah. And then I didn't have any work at that time. I was, I started working on this book. I started thinking about
Dan, I have to disagree with you. You were working, you were hodling.
Exactly. I agree. Yeah, it was like rooting for a baseball team, right? You're not really doing anything to help them, but you're like expending a lot of mental energy.
Dan, what are you doing? I'm at the coffee shop huddling.
Exactly. I just made 10 grand. I just lost 100 grand. Get out of here.
I'm working really hard right now at this coffee shop.
You don't know all the thoughts in my head, all the plans. Yeah, it was a lot of that. And I started working on the outlines of this book. And then eventually Eileen quit her clients too, because she was sick of me talking about this. And we were up like 4 million. And we had a deal where if it did crash, we'd already gotten our initial investment out, so we'd be back to square one. If we did crash, then I'd be the first one to have to go get a job. And I was like, sure. I'm like, there's no way this thing's crashing. You know, it's like, this is going up, baby. So,
nice. Yeah. Awesome. That's awesome. Yeah. We'll save some stories from the book for hopefully some people that are going to go pick up this book now. And I also heard that when you wrote the book, you actually cut out about 150 pages from the book. Is that true?
Yes. And you want me to talk a little bit about what that was?
Yeah. Well, I heard that you cut it out to craft a story, to kind of write a narrative. You know, not everything that you think is going to be good for a story really works.
Yeah.
But what I really want to know is if you could share some of the stories or the vignettes or things that happened that you left out of the book that would maybe be interesting to people.
Yeah, sure. It was, a lot of that was, was Acme stuff. You know, when I started writing the book, I was still stung. You know, basically I got fired from Acme. I described that in the book. And I had never really been fired. I had never been fired from a job before. So it was just like, you know, could you believe this? Even though it was a terrible fit and I couldn't have been surprised. And didn't have to do with drugs or alcohol, because I was sober for four years then.
So in the first draft, chapters 5, 6, and 7 were just trashing Acme?
Exactly. They were. It was revenge memoir. It was a lot of that. It was just going really deep into the process of the company and, you know, and that kind of a thing. And I had a professional editor I was working with. I had a bunch of different teams of people I was working with on this. I mean, from editing to publicity and whatever. You know, I none of it's too expensive in publishing, because it's kind of a struggling industry. And I had a really good editor who would tell me, you really want someone who's going to like ruin your day with her edits. And basically her feedback was like, listen, this is like way too much here. You're starting to look bitter. People don't care. It's called Confessions of a Crypto Millionaire, which it wasn't my original title either, but it was but that's what people are going to come to the book for. And so you need to more quickly move to that. And that's how I weaved in the kind of a parallel story at the beginning about what was happening in crypto at the same time I was going through it. And I cut way back on all the Acme anecdotes, because you get a good sense of it just from, I mean, it's already like 50 pages. You get a sense of what that is. So there was that. And then I had more anecdotes about the process of before I invested. You know, part of this book was to explain to people it wasn't just all luck, you know, and I'm not saying it was all skill either, but it was something weird that I've seen. It was a strange cocktail, as I talked about, that lots of other hodlers have said, wow, I totally recognize that. It was just some strange mix of desires and whatever. Well, that sounds weird, but you know what I mean? So I had a lot of and the editor's comment was like, you're still thinking about doing this. We know you did it. You know, we know you actually are going to buy. And I had a scene in there where I met Vitalik. He came out to the Silicon Valley Ethereum meetup, and I waited in line. And like some of these engineers, like they're just shy of the spectrum and they just would not let him go. And I wasn't getting get my chance to meet him. So I kind of like butted in and like shook his hand, you know, and you know, he's like a young guy. He's like 20, you know, he's like obviously really thin and he's just like very unique looking, and he's growing into his body since then. But, you know, he's like a awkward young guy. And I was just like, you know, I said, oh, I heard you on that podcast, you know, and there was some idiot interviewing him. And I heard everything these days. It's all I did was listen and watch Ethereum. And I said, you really suffer fools gladly, or you really suffer fools well. And, you know, it was like, obviously, like, what am I talking about, myself here? Like, that's like all I had to say. And he's like, you know, thank you or whatever. And I was just like staring at him. And it was,
did you ever see the Fit Vitalik fake ICO?
No, I haven't seen that.
That's hilarious. It's basically an ICO that was trying to get Vitalik healthy. So I think they raised like 23 ETH or something, 23 Ethereum for that.
Oh my God, I'm not surprised. So anyway, there was stuff like that, anecdotes like that. But he, you know, and I in the, like, it's kind of hard to be Vitalik because, you know, he's like almost like a, he has like a godlike presence. You know, again, Bitcoin people would just like puke when I said that. But, you know, he's just odd. He's an outlier. He's like brilliant and, you know, super thin. And, you know, he's, yeah. So it was, but at that point I had to, the other stuff was just drove the plot more than that. And it wasn't really a significant encounter, but that was probably the toughest one because I'm like, hey, I met Vitalik, you know, I made the call, but I'm like, you know what? At the end, I just wanted a story that had good pacing, and that's books that get read have good pacing. So,
yeah, definitely. I'm not just saying that because you're here, but I was laughing my ass off reading the book, and I also learned a few things as well. I kind of want to talk a little bit about just the. Not the contents of the book, but really the process of writing a book. I know you were also writing on Medium and doing writing in a few other places. So what was the process of writing the book? Was it easy for you? Was it hard? Did it take a lot more work than you were expecting? Because a lot of people, they always talk about, oh, I'm going to write a book. And most people never do. Obviously, you're kind of cashed out. You'd quit Acme. You had quit your crypto consulting. So you just kind of focused on writing a book. Is that correct?
Yeah. Yeah, that's right. It was both easy and hard. Easy in that I was super motivated because I love memoirs. And I also, like I said, I got heavily into Medium and I was writing memoir posts, like, you know, like essays about my life and stuff like that, which had been fairly well received. And so I figured I could do it. And then it was this whole idea of both the greed and the idealism and the fact that I had worked in this centralized company and I had been enamored with this decentralization. And then I just knew there was a great hook because I ended up making a bunch of money. And it's what people like me previously had dreamed of doing, but it never happens. And it actually happened. So I felt like I'd been given this, like, you know, just this amazing opportunity of the thing to write about. It was almost like a double blessing, the money plus this story to tell. And I had never written about my addiction before, and I knew that that would wrap into it. So writing it, the way it works is when you want to write a book is you just have to sit down and get started, and you have to just say, and this is like so hard to do. You just keep at it, keep writing the first draft. So I did that, and it wasn't like the hardest thing I had ever done. But when you do that and you do it regularly, even if it doesn't all fit, but you keep making progress, it's just like you wake up one day and you have like 25,000 words, which is like, I don't know, maybe 100 pages or something. And then it's like, oh my God, this could be a book. And then you get a new burst of enthusiasm because it's like, wow, I have all this work in here. And if you plot out what else you want to say, it's like, it suddenly becomes like, oh yeah, this is completely doable. Whereas in the beginning phases, it's like, I don't know if I can do this. I don't know if I can do this. You know, it's like so much more to go. And then the hardest part was, you know, I had like 3 full drafts, and each time I had a full draft, I thought like, this is perfect. Like, this is approaching brilliant. This is like, going to make a mark in the literary world. And this is a very common thing that writers have because you've poured everything into it and you're totally blind to the blind spots, to your blind spots. And so I had good editors, like friends at first. And then this professional editor who I hired, who would just tell me like it is. And there was like, just, you're completely crestfallen because at this point, you're just so sick of writing this book. And, you know, when you think about it, I'd lived crypto for 2 years. Now I was reliving it, writing this book. I was so sick of talking about myself in the book. I was so sick of trying to, you know, and you're just like super tired. And so that's the hardest part, is when you get an honest edit, actually doing the work to make it better. But I somehow found, you know, I was really lucky because I didn't have a job. This was the only thing I was doing. And I was still like on this super high from making all the money. So it was like, in crypto, when I started writing, crypto was so hot. I was like, this is going to be a bestseller because everyone wants to know about crypto. And this is exactly what I would have wanted to read. So that's the way it goes. And then you just keep going. And pretty soon you're near the end. You know you're not going to stop. It's super painful, but you just follow through and do it.
Yeah, definitely. It seems like you obviously had the freedom to write the book, you know, whenever. A lot of people, they write a book in their free time, which has got to be quite a task. And a lot of people, they just, you know, they write it, they maybe have their significant other look at it, maybe some friends or family, and they just like, hey, I'm just going to self-publish it. I think it's great. So not everyone can maybe afford it, but would you recommend hiring a professional editor? It sounds like it really benefited your book.
Yeah, I definitely would. If you really want people to, you have to. I don't care who you are. I mean, all the biggest authors have professional editors. And if you listen to publishing podcasts, they all talk about how painful it was doing revisions because they have blind spots too. And the thing about it was I thought, because I'd never done anything like this, I thought, okay, this is great. I've got this editor. She's going to send me back like a new version. She will have like made a bunch of edits. And yeah, she cleaned up sentences and stuff like that, but it's more there. It's called a development edit. And that's what you need when it's not ready to go yet. And it's basically telling you what you need to do with an outside perspective. They don't do it for you. I was like, oh shit. You know, I was looking forward to getting some new copy here that's still mine, but it's been edited. But
like she was going to kind of ghostwrite parts of it or something.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. You were like, I should have hired a ghostwriter for this.
Exactly. Yeah. That's a ghostwriter.
Yeah, exactly. It's really interesting. I'm glad that you did it though. And, did you actually record an audiobook for this? Did you do the narration yourself or did you get an actor to do the voice?
I did it myself. And that was, you know, every step of the process you have to research, but it's a memoir. I just couldn't stomach having someone else read it. And I didn't know how it would turn out, but I had a really great producer and I went to San Diego for 4 days and just read all day long. And the last day is all corrections. And I think it seems to have turned out well. People like the audiobook, and so that was good. It was hard, but it was good.
All right, cool. That sounds good. So what are you planning to do in the next what are you doing in 2020 and the rest of this decade? Now you're retired, so you're just enjoying your retirement, spending time with your family and your wife and kids and friends, yeah, and stuff like that. Are you golfing? Are you doing anything extracurricular, anything interesting, or you just nothing much has changed apart from you got a lot more money in the bank now?
Yeah, well, it's so basically because I wanted to establish myself as a writer, I'm thinking about my next book, and that's not easy for a memoirist because, you know, I had this big story, nothing's going to equal that, but I'm batting around ideas and concepts for another book. And so that's one thing, and that'll take up most of my time. And then, as you know, you have three kids, your time gets eaten up with drive, especially when you're available. You drive them to soccer, you drive them, you know, go to the grocery store, and it's all very good because you're spending more time with your family. But you do realize that, you've got to set up like time where it's just you, because, you know, you can find like a whole week's gone by and it's like, what have I done? I want to give back too, and I've been volunteering once a week at a food shelter, and at a homeless shelter, and I like that. But I don't want to join a board of one. I just want to like do the volunteering. So it's for selfish reasons too, to try to be more like in the moment. You know, I spent all this time thinking about the future with crypto, thinking about myself, how I'm going to prove everyone wrong with the crypto, and all of a sudden I wrote the book. Oh my God, people are going to love this, blah, blah, blah. So it's like, I just trying to like pull away from like all these big dream thoughts.
Yeah. That's nice that you're giving back and doing some charity work, giving back to the homeless. Have you thought about doing some charity work and giving to the no coiners or no?
No, I think they'll be fine on their own. Oh, the no coiners. Yeah. Yeah, and they're in force right now. You know, I know that because when I'm marketing the book, you know, there's the general perception among a lot of the public is that it was just all complete fad. It's, you know, it's like Beanie Babies. It's gone, not going to come back.
Yeah, well, like you know, and Josh knows, and our listeners know, the market's had a lot of crazy swings before too. They've got a short memory. They're like, yeah, my friend bought Bitcoin at 18,000 and he lost a whole bunch of money. Well, I'm like, you should have hodled because it would have went back eventually and then some.
Yeah, exactly. And you know, no one has a crystal ball, but it just seems hard for me to, it's hard for me to imagine when you look behind the covers at all the stuff happening that it doesn't pop again. I mean, I just don't see how it doesn't. I really don't, you know?
Yeah. So what's the 2020 update for Dan? So you're kind of writing, you're maybe thinking about doing a book, and you're just hodling your moonbag of ETH. And are you also following the project closely these days? Are you following crypto a lot or a little bit or not quite as much? Or
Well, after I wanted to pull away a little bit because I had been so focused on it. So I'm not following it nearly as closely as I was before. But I do follow it fairly closely. I don't know. It's hard to say, as opposed to some normal person, way more closely. But yeah, well, nothing like before. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, Dan, it's hard to pull away when you're trying to change the world.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Well, and I thought, like, well, maybe I should. I've gone to crypto conferences, and the thing is that because I'm not, you know, technical, nor do I want to really invest the time to become more technical. There's only so much you can contribute. My book, I felt, was a contribution. I always thought of it as a contribution to crypto, to explain to people how a normal person could fall down this rabbit hole. Not saying judgments about you should too or whatever. So my next book will definitely have some crypto in it. It might be something like, if I do sign this movie deal, following that'll be like a parallel story with something else happening in my life. So the movie deal, I don't know. I haven't figured it out yet.
Hey Dan, let me give you some unsolicited business advice.
Okay.
If you get a movie deal, tell them they have to pay you in ETH.
Exactly. They'll be like, what? Do you remember that ransom? There was a ransom story about Bitcoin. And the funniest thing was, it was like this like Filipino family, they had someone kidnapped, and the ransom had to be paid in Bitcoin. And there was this whole article on it. And like the biggest complaint of the family was like, how do we buy Bitcoin? And like, we had to buy Bitcoin. We had to go to this person and like, what the hell is this stuff? And it was like,
it wasn't that a family member friend was kidnapped.
Yes. It was like, it turned into like an anti-crypto piece.
They wouldn't accept fiat for their ransom?
Yeah, they're like, there was a limit. We had to buy in two different exchanges and like all this stuff.
Well, one thing that I was thinking about, because I wrote it down, is like, you said you were born in 1971, right? So, and you said you were 48 and a half. So yeah. That makes you exactly 15 years older than me, really. And I think in the last 15 years, so much has changed in the world, you know? Like, Facebook was just getting started. Smartphones were not even in people's pockets. The internet was still in its absolute infancy. Cryptocurrency was not yet properly invented yet. I mean, there was Bitgold and other things that were being worked on, but Bitcoin hadn't even been conceptualized yet. So it's been a crazy run in the last 15 years. So my question is kind of, what changes do you foresee in the next 15 years? What things do you think is going to happen in terms of technology around the world?
Yeah, that's a good question. I think that a couple things. One, and this is just obviously my opinion, I'm not, you know, whatever, take it for what it's worth, but I think the backlash against social media will continue, and that I think that the way it impacts me the most and my kids the most is, and I'm sure, Josh, that you have the same situation where, how do you deal with social media and screens with your kids and the attention economy and all that stuff. I mean, it just seems like it's, the more I've learned, I've gotten into meditation a little bit, just to be a cliche here, but it's true. You know, meditation is great. It's something that is good for me. And because it pulls me away from the dreams and stuff, more to like the day to day, but social media and the attention economy with all the apps and everything, it seems like, I just feel like there's going to be more pulling away from that. And we'll look back on the fact that how we were all so obsessed with it. Well, I'm not super optimistic that we'll be able to fully pull away from it. Obviously, I don't think that'll ever happen, but I do think there'll be more controls that will, you know, families will put on kids and that you'll put on yourself, and you'll look at it as smoking if you're looking at your screen all day. At least I hope. I think that's one thing. And then, I mean, I really do think that, you know, with all the work happening in crypto, I think there are going to be some big disruptions and that it's going to go mainstream in ways we might not even expect, you know, in weird ways that you just can't have a crystal ball to see what it's all going to be used for. But I think that there'll be some of that.
Well, we touched on Facebook a little bit, and you mentioned social media. So we have to kind of ask this question, which is quite obvious now, which is, what do you think about Libra? Do you think that Facebook's cryptocurrency is ever going to get off the ground? I personally don't think the US government is going to allow it to get off the ground. So what are your thoughts on that one?
Yeah, I agree. And at my last job, I did a lot of lobbying too. And those letters that got sent to Facebook like the week after it was announced are just like devastating. I mean, that's just like a decade of regulatory approvals. Plus, I mean, it's funny. Everyone was ready to bash it, and as was I. And I know there's some real technology behind Libra. It's not like a total BS block. It's not even really a blockchain, but there's some innovation there, you know, in what they're proposing. And Eric Voorhees did a really great Twitter thread on Libra, and you know, he's number one libertarian. And he dismantled parts of it and was applauding other parts of it. And I really appreciate like him and people like the guy who runs Messari. I can't remember his name. Ryan Selkis. I love the way they approach things because they're very they take look at it like as rational and things. But for me, I'm all about decentralization and the idea of Mark Zuckerberg and Facebook, you know, having the biggest stake in crypto or having the number one platform. It's just like, oh, but in the short term, I mean, it could pop up prices and, you know, give credit to the whole industry. But to answer your question, no, I agree with you. I don't think it's going to ever come to fruition.
Did you ever get to read the book, The Starfish and the Spider, before? Because that's a big book about decentralization. No. And this came
out. I'm sorry. You cut out there a little bit. What's it called?
The Starfish and the Spider. It's a book about decentralization. I think you'd really love it. And it was released around 2005. It was definitely before Bitcoin's time. So it was pretty interesting. And it definitely was one of the books that helped to grow the idea of decentralization. I'm sure it was influenced for some of the people behind Bitcoin. And then I have to ask you too, who do you think is Satoshi Nakamoto? Do you think it was an individual person? Was it a group of people? Is he still alive? Is it Crazy Craig Wright? Who is it? Like, what do you think?
I definitely don't think it's Craig Wright for all the obvious reasons. He'd move the coins. And I don't think someone with his temperament could invent it. That's my opinion, Craig. I think Hal Finney was – I think if I had to bet, I'd say Hal Finney and a group of collaborators. There was the guy that died, right?
Kleinman?
Yeah, I think that was
Dave Kleinman.
Yeah, he died.
That's the Kleinman Craig Wright rice suit. Some people think Kleinman was it and Craig Wright was kind of working with him. But yeah, Hal Finney, I tend to think it's maybe a group of people, but it's the thing that makes me question if it's a group of people is how do they all keep it all secret? They've got to have like some sort of blood oath or something, you know?
That's a good point because no one can ever keep a secret. Yeah, I don't know. It's fascinating though. Do you guys want to know who Satoshi is? Like, do you think it'd be good if he came out and could prove it?
Oh, I don't know. That's a good question. Probably best left as, you know, a ghost, anonymous. I think it makes some more intrigue for people. And plus, it doesn't get all of the politics involved. I mean, some of the things that we have talked about on the show in the past is that how heads of projects basically become like almost these like fake statesmen, these types of people that are making speeches, like pretending that they're the new United Nations or something like that. And I think that that's the advantage that Bitcoin has in the sense that there isn't someone who can lay claim to that and say, this is my way of doing things. I know there are lots of people who said it might be me or it might be this other person. And there are different people that think it might be Nick Szabo and other people like that. So I think personally, it's best left as a mystery. And I think we've touched on that before, right?
Yeah. Well, I think the person or the group is either dead or they're never going to come public with it. You know, it's, you know, if you got an ego, you want to be like, hey, I did this. But I think, you know, this person was smart enough to cover their tracks. We haven't been able to figure out who they are. And maybe it's like a selfless gift to the world. Maybe not so selfless, because if they ever cash out their coins, they're going to be quite wealthy. But also, if they cash out their coins, they might be able to be discovered through blockchain analysis.
Yeah. And it might crash Bitcoin because they have so much. If they cash out a little, it's like, oh my God, are they going to cash out $20 billion worth or whatever?
Yeah. So I don't think those coins can ever really move because it would cause massive panic selling all around the world.
God, I mean, don't you just love that about crypto, though? I mean, it's insane. No one knows who Satoshi is. I mean, my God.
Yeah, it's incredible, really. And the technology itself is a fundamental improvement on, you know, double entry accounting. Now you've got a public ledger, so you can actually make transfers of data to anyone around the world in a peer-to-peer fashion. So I absolutely love it.
Okay, yeah. Well, I think we're about ready to wrap it up today. Before we get going, Dan, do you want to give us any Bitcoin or Ethereum price predictions?
You know what? I will, just because everyone, no one ever does. I've already gone the full Monty here by talking about all my coins and the prices and things like that. So no one should follow this because I'm absolutely not. No one should necessarily follow this according to what I say because I'm absolutely not an investment advisor. But I would say I feel comfortable saying that, in my opinion, it's January right now. I think that by August, Bitcoin will be above 20,000 again, and Ethereum will be above 500 again. And then I think that within, I think that within 3 years, that Ether will be above its all-time high, and that Bitcoin will probably be, 30,000 or something. And again, I'm just saying this because you never hear predictions like this. I always want them to be like, don't tell me it's going to grow a lot. Like, give me a price, even though you don't know. I know you don't know, but what's your opinion? If I had to bet, I'd say that's where we're going to be at.
Yeah, well, I think those are pretty bullish bets. I like those because, like you, Dan, I'm a hodler.
I love it.
All right. Well, I think that'll just about do it for us today. We really appreciate you coming on the show. Josh, you have any closing thoughts? And then Dan, I can leave you with the last word for today.
Yeah, thanks for coming on the show, Dan. It's been a pleasure letting you sharing your story and letting us know about how you all came to this part of your life. And now you're going to really get and do what you really want in your life. Now you can focus on writing and you've escaped corporate hell, so congratulations on that. Now you can build a life that makes you happy, and I think that's what we should all think about, how we can enjoy our life. So on that note, thanks for coming in, and I'll pass it over to you to wrap it up.
Oh, thanks, guys. Hey, yo, thank you. I really appreciate the opportunity. And hey, I really appreciate the work that you guys are doing. I've been on a lot of podcasts, and you guys really take it seriously, ask great questions, do your research. And I think as this thing really picks up, like, we're going to need a lot more voices like you guys provide that really takes the time to get to the root of whatever story someone has. So thank you. And this has been a lot of fun.
Yeah, well, we really appreciate it. Maybe in the future when space technology improves, maybe you can take a rocket with Elon and meet us on the dark side of the Hoddle Moon.
Thank you for joining us on Dark Side of the Hoddle Moon. If you haven't already subscribed, please do so. Also, be sure to join our Telegram group, follow us on Twitter and Instagram, and follow us on BitChute and YouTube, where you can find all the episodes as well as highlights from previous episodes. You can also visit us at darksideofthehoddlemoon.com.
Hoddle Moon!